Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Buffering the Vampire Slayer, a podcast where we're watching and discussing every episode of Buffy one at a time, sometimes more than once. In this case, here we are to discuss more about the gift. More gifts.
More. Jen, listen, I want to preface this by saying that I love you all so much, and I'm so happy to be here in this episode, but Jenny can attest to the fact that over the last week, I've been like, why did I do this to myself? Why did I add another episode to myself? But I mean, it's worth it. In the end, always, it is worth it, but, you know.
Let's make a bonus episode, she said. It'll be so fun, she said.
Oh, but it is. It is very fun. And here's why. Because in this conversation, we have four things to offer to you. One is a conversation that I had with Jen Malkowski, who you may remember from The Body. We will give Jen a proper introduction before we go into my conversation with them, but it's pretty fucking great. And it focuses on death as her gift and the moment that Buffy jumps off of that tower. We have a conversation with Mac McDade. For the first time, Mac is in our ears.
Huzzah!
Bringing us all sorts of feelings about Buffy herself and also Spike.
Spike, I love you. Spike, so dreamy. Spike, you trench coat.
Last, but certainly nowhere near to least, we have a conversation with LaToya Ferguson, who you well know by now is going to be coming into our podcast feed, bringing with her season 3 of Angel on Top.
Oh, hell yes. Yeah. Kristen, I don't mean to nitpick, but you said we had four things to offer them, and that was only three.
You're right. The fourth thing is you. We have you to offer to you.
Ah, yes.
We have emails that you sent in. We have questions that you sent in specific to the gift. We will have a longer, more expansive season 5 mailbag for you in a few weeks. But this is specific to the gift. We have a few of you who wrote in with your experiences of watching the episode for the first time. We have a few of you who wrote in with questions. So that's what you're going to get from Jenny and I right now and in between those conversations. So, waha, I did have four things, and I know how to do math.
Hail math. Now, speaking of math, let's do a brief refresher on percentages with the results of the final sexual tension awards of season 5. In fourth place, not for Anya's lack of trying, it's Anya and Xander with 9% of the vote. That's, I assume, 100% of the vote for Anya and then negative 91% of the vote for Xander. In second place, it's a pairing as old as time. It's Spike and Blood with 18% of the vote. Spike and the fluid that flows through human veins got twice the votes that Anya and Xander got. In second place, with 25% of the vote, Buffy and Glory, who, you know, might have deserved better if it weren't for the absolute, indisputable, dominating power of our winners with 48% of the vote. It's Buffy and Spike!
Buffy and Spike, congratulations. What a way to end season 5. You know what I mean, Jenny? What a way. Now, if you don't know this already, you probably do. But if you don't know already, every season, at the end of the season, because she loves us and because she loves you, Emily McLongstreet, the wonderful, runs a sexual tension award showdown, which means you get to vote on all 22. In this case, I believe it was 23 because, Jenny, she did put me in the running against you specifically, and I won, just so you know.
Hey, congratulations.
But you can vote in four rounds. We're in the third round now. You can find it at bufferingthevampireslayer.com/STA. That stands for Sexual Tension Awards. It will take you to where we are in the quiz. And in just a couple of days, I think, we will find out who is the crowning champion of sexual tension in season 5. Thank you, Emily.
Wow.
Always, always, always just like doing the Lord's work out there.
All hail, Brackets McLongstreet. Thank you for your service.
We mentioned that you're going to hear from Mac in this episode. Jenny and I are in conversation with Mac, and you've heard a bit over the last few months about our work with Mac, who is facilitating our anti-racism reading and discussion groups, and who is also consulting with us in the Buffering universe, helping us create an anti-racist base here at Buffering the Vampire Slayer. And Alba, who is our new producer, working alongside Jenny and I in the production end of things, watching the episodes. She's watching season 6 with me right now as we get ready to jump into that season. Alba and Mac are going to have a conversation with each other, and that conversation is going to air next week on September 16th. And it's just going to be the two of them talking about coming into the universe here, coming into the Buffering universe, their goals, what they hope to achieve with their work with us, and just some of their thoughts and feelings about what the experience has been like so far. So I'm really, really excited to listen to that episode. 2 weeks later, on September 30th, we will have a season 5 mailbag. normally I have like 80 emails or so that I have starred going into a mailbag. I have like over 200 right now. So everybody, please wish me luck. I'm going to do my best.
Good luck
to curate a mailbag for you. And then, so you all know, we will be back, come hell or high water, with season 6, episode 1 on October the 7th. And then we're off to the fucking races again, aren't we, Jenny?
Here we go.
Hey, also, Jenny, you make this thing. It's called music. And we have an album that's ready for pre-order, don't we?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Songs from season 5, the Buffering the Vampire Slayer musical experience is ready for launch. It is in the chamber awaiting its expulsion into the realm of the living.
Yeah, the album Songs from Season 5 is available in our store. You can find that by going to bufferingthevampireslayer.com. Just click on store. The CD, the physical CD, will be available in our US and our UK store. Again, limited quantities, so snag them if you want the physicals. And if you don't want to get physical, you can get digital.
Wow.
That's right. So if you want to get a digital copy of the songs, they will be releasing on Friday, October 9th, because in the music industry, which I am a part of, we release music on Fridays. That's the day to release music. Friday, October 9th. What a day. Also, just a heads up, you should probably tune into that mailbag because we're going to announce a live show. Inside mailbag. So, you know.
Okay. So I'm going to start.
Yeah.
I'm going to read an email.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here it is, our first freaking email in this episode from Lindsay. Lindsay writes, do you think Faith knew / felt Buffy's sacrifice when it happened? Did anyone go and tell her? Stop forgetting Faith, Scoobs. I wish she had been included, considered, or cast in the season finale somehow.
Mm.
Yeah, Lindsay.
Yeah.
Justice for Faith. Where is Faith? Why doesn't anyone ever care about her?
Well, also, like, what I like about Lindsay's question is it's kind of like twofold. It's like, one, what the fuck? Why does no one ever think about Faith? And two is like, do you think Faith sensed that? Like, do you think that because there are two Slayers that she somehow knows what's up without even being told?
I kind of think maybe she does.
Right? I think she does, too. I mean, like, if you can speak to each other in, like, weird dreams with cats and, like, coded 730 to dawn messages, I think you know if the other one has died, I would think.
Yeah, yeah. They're inextricably tethered to one another for all time.
They are, aren't they? I also think that Eliza Dushku is probably not able, like, if they had wanted to bring Faith back, they probably wouldn't have been able to at this point because I looked it up and Bring It On came out in August of 2000. This episode came out May of 2001. It seems like Eliza's career was probably in a very particular place at the time that this was airing.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe
Busy Lady Plaza.
Yeah, Busy Lady Plaza indeed. Maybe she did get asked. Maybe the writer's room, at least, if not the Scoobies, did think of Faith, but it was not possible. Okay, I have an email, Jenny. This email comes from Melissa, and Melissa says, one thing that always stood out to me, aside from the crushing way that Spike breaks down upon seeing Buffy's body, was that both times that Buffy dies in the show, she tells another character to, quote, tell Giles. In season one's Prophecy Girls, she tells Miss Callender that, quote, when he wakes up, tell him, I don't know, think of something cool, tell him I said it. Now, 4 years later, Buffy has grown as both a slayer and a woman, and we as the viewer, and the only people to witness both quotes besides the Chosen One herself, are able to mark that growth in her second set of last words to her watcher, quote, tell Giles I figured it out and I'm okay. She's no longer a 16-year-old who doesn't want to die. She's the slayer. Woof, Melissa. Woof. There's so many. You'll hear Jen and I talk about another parallel that I didn't even know existed until I spoke with them. And I feel like every time we've had a conversation about this episode since the first one, more and more, like, did you know that this overlaps with that has happened? Like, there's so much that you can draw from The Gift back to either Prophecy Girl or other moments in the series that came before.
I just have a premonition that I'm going to get a lot of things in my eye over the course of this episode.
You should really get that taken care of, Jenny.
I know. I need safety goggles to make this pod. Okay. Here's another email from Julia.
A lot of you sent in your experiences of watching The Gift for the first time. And so we just picked three to share in these like little interstitials. So each one will have one of your experiences with watching this episode and like what it means to you specifically.
Now that's what I call producing. Great idea. Okay, here's the first one of those from Julia. Julia writes, this episode is everything to me. Growing up, my parents were always split, so I knew nothing but two households with two separate sets of rules. My dad was much more lax than my mom and a big sci-fi nerd, so I grew up playing with pewter figurines and reading Piers Anthony. From a young age, my dad begged me to watch Buffy, but I was very self-censored as a child, and at 8 years old in 1998, I told him I thought I was too young for the mature content. Eventually, he broke me down, and it became our tradition to watch his VHS-recorded episodes of Buffy and Angel each weekend.
Oh, I know.
On the car ride to his house on Friday afternoons, I would beg him to tell me what happened in each episode prior to my watching. I love spoilers. There were a few episodes he wouldn't spoil for me, The Gift being one of them. I went into this episode at 11 years old, not knowing what to expect. 1 year after The Gift premiered, my dad died unexpectedly of a heart attack. It happened on a Sunday, after a fun weekend of us being together, as always. Life was different for me after that, but I've always had Buffy to connect with my dad. I write to you now because in the 12 years I had of knowing my awesome dad, I only saw him cry twice. Yes, I know, the patriarchy. Two times in 12 years, and I can remember each time feeling so close to him, to his emotions. The first time I saw my dad cry was during Becoming Part 2, with Angel whimpering Buffy seconds before she plunges a sword through his heart. We cried together for Buffy and for the weight of the world on her shoulders. The second and final time I saw my dad cry was here during The Gift, starting at It's Summer's Blood, just like mine, and reaching its peak as Spike cries over Buffy's body. I don't know if words can convey what this episode means to me. I now work as a children's grief therapist, working every day alongside bereaved children, having walked their walk myself. It's because of losing my father that I know how to help in this capacity. And it feels like the best gift a father could have ever given his daughter, a career. It's almost like death is my gift.
I know. It's a lot.
Julia!
I should have gotten those goggles a little earlier, Jenny.
I know!
Yeah, Julia, thank you so much for sharing this. You know, everybody Send us such incredible stories in this one, as you could tell by Jenny barely making it through the reading of that.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it was really, really powerful. And also, Julia let us know that she works at Olivia's House, a grief and loss center for children, which is in Pennsylvania. And so, you know, if you want to look more into that, that is there for you. And thank you for the work that you do, Julia. And thank you for sending us that email, which I thought would not only be really powerful to share with all of you listeners, but also a great way to sort of jump into my conversation with Jen Malkowski, which, of course, anchors on this quote or this like recurring quote, recurring theme in season five, which is death as Buffy's gift. If you don't know from our episode on the body, Jen is a professor at Smith College, and they are also the author of Dying in Full Detail, Mortality and Digital Documentary. So they have a very specific know-how about death and dying as it is portrayed in media. And so we have a conversation, which I think is a really beautiful bookend to our conversation around the body, about some of their thoughts on this episode and their thoughts on this quote and this theme in general. I also want to give you all as listeners a content warning. Jen and I do discuss suicide in this interview. So if you want to skip the interview and the conversation, it is about 17 and a half minutes long. So if you jump forward and you don't want to hear that conversation, you can, about 17 and a half minutes. And for those of you who do want to listen to our conversation, how about we step on over into it? Oh my goodness. Jen Malkowski, I told you I was going to get you back on this podcast. Jen Malkowski is here with us today. Jen, you are a professor at Smith College. You really have done a lot of deep dives research-wise into death and its representation in media. And you spoke with us about the body this season. And I just want to tell you, listeners, if you have not heard my conversation with Jen for the body, please go back and listen to it. We actually released it the same day as we released our episodic discussion because it was so powerful and just so wonderful to hear you. And so, Jen, you know, when Buffy was like, oh, death is my gift, death is my gift, you know, I thought, well, who better to call, really?
You know, this is a supernatural show with a lot of violence. I'm probably not going to be out of work doing guest spots for you guys.
That's true. A lot of people are dying all the time on this show. Talk to us. Just jump in here, because I know that you can and will. Wonderfully. And tell us sort of what your connection is between like the conversation that we had with the body and that death. And then here we have Buffy dying and this message of death is your gift.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing for me to say, the body and the gift, these two episodes toggle back and forth for me as my number one and number two favorites in the whole series. Like, this is a show that does death well. I really think both of these episodes are like masterpieces of television. And I think they're both really brilliant portrayals of death in their own way, which might be surprising given what I said about the body. So we get to that. But I think one thing to note, like, is that this episode references the body in a number of ways. It does it directly with Buffy saying, I wish my mom were here. Things like that, references to Joyce and her death in the episode. But if you watch, there are like other kind of like super interesting subtle references. And the one I really noticed in this rewatch was when Buffy and Dawn are up on top of the tower and Buffy is telling Dawn what she's going to do, right? Mm. We actually have like a direct callback to the shot where she tells Dawn that Joyce has died. Mm. It's the same orientation of their two bodies. It's the same like kind of touching her, like Dawn crying. The sound is cut out in both of them so that we don't hear right away what's being said. So it's this moment that's mirrored in, I think, a very intentional way of telling Dawn this heartbreaking news about the death of a loved one. Mm-hmm. But this time it's Buffy herself. And it invites us to compare those two deaths in a way that I think we naturally do with their proximity in the show. So
I'm sorry, you've rendered me speechless. I like did not notice that parallel. And so like, I know I'm supposed to be like hosting a podcast here, but listen, I have feelings too. And you just gave like that parallel, realizing it for the first time, as I'm sure some of our listeners just did hearing you say that. I had like full body chills because this show, it's like, God, how many times can you watch it? And it just keeps giving you things that you didn't have before.
Totally. I mean, to like, just to make you feel better, I've probably seen this episode over a dozen times. Yeah. And it was just last night watching it again, being like, crap, I got to think of some smart things to say for this podcast. That I actually noticed that visual callback to that moment.
Wow.
So I think you're absolutely right that there's just so much built into the show. You can discover these new gems watching it again for the 12th time.
I don't want to take you off your course because I know that you have a lot to share with us, but something that has come up a lot, both from listener feedback and just like, you know, touched upon in our conversation, is the phrasing of death as your gift. And so, again, like if you want to dig into that later, we can. But this idea of death being a gift, and is it the gift that Buffy is giving to us? Is it a gift that Buffy is given? Like, what? I would love to hear your thoughts there, too.
Right. And it's such a nice phrase that the writing team played with in this season because it has so many resonances. I think the fake out is we're supposed to think a gift like a talent, right? She has a talent for delivering death, for killing. I think, you know, the revelation in this episode, I'm not sure if it's supposed to be that death, like Buffy's gift, she gives death as a gift, her own death as a gift to Dawn and the world to save it, right? But I think, you know, maybe a more interesting reading is that, you know, it's a gift she's receiving. This is where one of the darkest parts of the episode in the series comes in for me, because I think there's a really deep resonance with suicide in the way that Buffy dies, despite all the themes of heroism, right? At this moment in the arc of her character, she's so emotionally overwhelmed and overstretched. She has this endless chain of crises that fall to her to solve. She's, you know, she's lost so much. She's grieving so hard. She has this support network of friends, but it's stretched so thin with everything that's going on. I think in a way, you know, the thought of death is presented here as a relief to Buffy. You can see that in this moment that she realizes that she can die instead of Dawn. You get that shot where she turns, she sees the sunrise, and just that feeling of calm, right? I think it's useful to compare Sarah Michelle Gellar's performance here. And honestly, Emmy for Sarah, right?
Oh, like my God, please.
This episode, that scene, but also the conversation with Giles at the Magic Box earlier. She's so good at what she needs to portray here. But if you look at her in that moment that she turns and she sees that sunrise, think back to the moment in Becoming Part Two when she sees that portal to hell opening behind Angel. It's a really similar, again, a really like mirrored kind of physical arrangement, you know, in terms of how the scene is shot. And in Becoming Part Two, it's this paralyzing, unthinkable horror, right? She's going to have to kill a loved one to save the world. But here we just get this wash of like peace, this end to struggle when she realizes she's facing her own death.
That look that you have noted, and I think we like noted, but not nearly enough in our discussion in the episode, but that look of relief on her face is one that I don't know that we've ever seen before in the series, which like is so powerful from a character standpoint, but like to your Emmy for Sarah point, we need to craft an Emmy together as listenership and mail it to Sarah Michelle Gellar because it's just stunning.
Right. It'll come in the mail with her many sexual attention awards.
Yes. It'll be a heavy package. Look out, Sarah.
No, I think she's just amazing in this episode. I mean, always, but this is a real kind of peak of something for her here. But I think that look also brings us back to the previous episode, The Weight of the World, right? We have that like moment that's repeated and repeated where she puts the book on the shelf. When she says, what she describes to Willow is that she kind of allowed herself to experience the relief she would feel if she just let Dawn die, right? And she says something like, I can't remember the exact phrase, but like, and then it could be done. Right. Like I could be done.
Right.
But here she discovers this different escape clause. She can die herself and be done. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what you see, I think, at this moment, as much as you might also see a kind of noble heroism. Mm-hmm. It's a psychological need for her that she's acting on as well. Mm-hmm. And I think if you do read this death as, a suicide or as kind of suicide adjacent, there are some troubling aspects to the episode and the way that it glorifies this act as heroic, mm-hmm. right? These tie in with a lot of psychology research about the potentially harmful effects of certain kinds of media portrayals of suicide. Mm-hmm. I think as a shorthand, you can kind of think of the show 13 Reasons Why as the poster child for all the ways you should not depict suicide in media, if you need a primer on that.
Right,
but
right.
Yeah, I mean, the suicide stuff here, to me, it's a really interesting theme to build in for Buffy's character and to show what she's kind of struggling with on a mental health level and where she is at this very weary juncture in her journey. But I also do just want to mention that there are some potential problems of playing out that storyline on a kind of ethical level here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like, where is that line? I mean, obviously I agree with you that the line is wiggly and without spoiling anything, I will say that that line that is wiggly here gets a hell of a lot wigglier as we move forward. And perhaps we can have you back again, Jen, to talk to us as we continue to lose our footing in what are we talking about? But this episode really roots it, you know, in many ways. Giles probably giving us the line itself, right? Like Buffy would never do this when he kills Ben, and you know, essentially saying like Buffy is this hero, and this is, you wrote in your email to me, you know, you used the phrase like a true hero's death,
right?
And so, like, what does separate one from the other? What makes this one thing and not the other, or is there a way to even separate the two?
I mean, I think you can think of this as a hero's death. You can think of it as kind of a suicide. You can think of it as, you know, one and the other. There's a lot of ways to read it. And I think that's, you know, as always, that's what Buffy does so well, is it builds in these subtleties and these kind of different resonances right. that are so rich to talk about.
Right.
But I'll come back to the hero's death. Or, like, the other main thing I want to say here in comparing the episode to the body.
Yeah.
So when I was on your show before, I praised the body, and many people have said this, for this really stark and raw depiction of natural death in an unglamorized way that's totally atypical of mainstream film and television. I think The Gift gives us supernatural death in a totally glamorized way. That's very typical of mainstream film and television, right? It's part of this mythic template that the show references. We have like the noble white knight, Buffy, climbing the tower to save the princess, Dawn. And you can look at all the costuming details, build this in. We even have a dragon that flies by.
I was going to say, there's a dragon.
It's referencing very old narrative tropes,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And when we actually get to the moment of Buffy's death, it's heroic. It's sublimely beautiful, the way it's shot. It happens in slow motion. It has this swelling emotional score over it. And Angel's death in Becoming, too, you know, the sacrifice Buffy makes by killing him was presented in a very similar way. So all those things I just mentioned are all the things that I said was so great about the body stripping away, right? That made it so powerful. And yet, I think The Gift is also a really powerful and really valuable portrayal of death. It's not a break at all from the usual format of Buffy or of television, but I think it's the pinnacle of it. It's this totally exemplary execution of these very old conventions of the hero's sacrifice.
It's just so great to hear you talk. Do you know that? Do you understand that? I here play the listener, and I'm just going to give voice to what everybody's feeling right now, which is like, keep talking.
I got to tell all my family members that. They hear me talk too much. But, you know, just to close that out, I think as much as I said last time that the body was something we need as this kind of portrayal of death's realism, I also think unrealistic portrayals of dramatic deaths like Buffy's in The Gift are psychologically useful. The realities of human mortality are very, very hard to face. We all know that. We know that for ourselves. We know that in the face of losing loved ones. Episodes like The Body try to break us out of the denial we often experience and help us, like guide us in confronting death. Mm-hmm. But episodes like The Gift give us this comfort of fiction, this vision of an individual death that's really grand and that really means something. Mm-hmm. I think it's not as revolutionary an episode as The Body, but it's definitely no less skillfully crafted. To me, when I watch this episode, it's like Buffy dies an epic death to save the world. We cry. I mean, I cry. I assume you cry. We all cry.
Oh, yeah. We all cry. I cry, you cry, we all cry for The Gift.
And it feels really simple. It feels really good. It's a good feeling. And I think there's no shame in actually just needing that from our fiction sometimes.
Right. Yeah, I was actually thinking about that this morning, just like life, you know, like you do when you wake up, you're like, whoa, life. But like, you know, I think part of what you're speaking to right now, too, is that like we do have to deal with these very real deaths and, you know, real losses in our life. But we also have to like get up and, to quote Buffy, keep living. And I think that like episodes like this and metaphors and, you know, fantastical stories like this episode, at least for me, resonate in a way that does help. Like, it does help me take the power of this episode to just keep fighting, to stand up and continue to face the world, you know, and like that, I think, is the other side of the reality of like sitting in a hospital room with a loved one and saying goodbye.
Absolutely. That's kind of where the episode leaves us, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, without saying too much, I'll just note everything about The Gift, where we leave things here, Buffy's death, I think thematically and tonally will be so boldly undercut in season six.
God.
I can't wait to hear you and Jenny talk about it. I hope you'll refer back to this episode as like this really stark contrast, to everything that's coming up, because this episode ends and you just have to think, where do we go from here?
Where do you go? Oh no. I cannot thank you enough. I hope that you come back to us in season six. I'm sure that there will be some dying there, you know, just like, you know, rough guess, if I had to guess. But it's just such an honor to have you on the podcast and to get to hear you talk. I know that our listeners feel the same as I do, like I just said, and just drawing some of these connections that it's almost like, and I'm sure you feel this way as a professor, right? That like the lines are kind of there in our minds somehow, but you can't really make complete sense of them. And then you just whoosh right in here and kind of like throw a light on those connections in a way that's beautiful. So thank you so much for talking to us about this
episode. Of course. Of course. And I think, you know, one of my favorite things about being a professor is that there's no authority. There's no one to say this is the right way to interpret this, right? I can throw something out there, but it's so cool to watch like the process of meaning making happen in the buffering community. And that's something I really value about the whole enterprise, just talking through the show together.
So powerful. Listen, I hope that like your day is full of things that aren't talking about death. You know, like I know you enjoy it, but you know, enjoy your life today. And I just want to let the listeners know, you know, you probably have learned about Jen through listening to them on The Body, but all of the information you need to learn more about their work is in the show notes today. And Jen, thank you again. And, you know, we'll see you, I hope, in season six.
Yeah, you know, wishing long life to everyone in the cast of characters. Maybe I'll never be back. You know, this could be the last time. No spoilers.
That's the shift that you were talking about tonally is actually that. It's just like no one dies in season six.
No one ever dies again.
Yeah,
so yeah, that's great. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show again, Kristen.
Of course. Jen, I'm telling you.
Yeah, what a fantastic conversation. Good job, both of you.
I mean, I didn't really do much of anything except for listen, but I just, you know, we talked about this in the interview, but you will definitely be hearing more from Jen as long as they will grace us with their presence, because I simply just love the way that their way of talking about things makes my brain explode, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Great. Okay, so before we meander over into the land of Mac McDade, we have a few more of your emails and stories to share. The first thing that I'm going to share with you is a note from Meredith, which is an experience with watching this episode. And instead of it being an experience watching this episode for the first time, it's Meredith's experience of watching it with us. Meredith says, I want to thank you both for guiding us through season 5 with such care and for encouraging me to slow down and savor the season for the first time in 19 years, as suggested by Paste's article, How Rewatch Podcasts Bring the Fight to Binge Culture. I've been watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer since 1997 when I was 9 years old. By 2005, I had all the seasons on DVD. I watched them repeatedly, but I always rushed. When I started listening to Buffering, you were already well into season 2, and I didn't rewatch seasons 1 to 3 because I knew them well enough to follow along. I started watching alongside you and Angel on Top in seasons 4 and 1 because I hadn't seen Angel quite as many times. Taking season 5 one episode at a time really allowed me to see and consider Buffy's arc in a way I'd never given myself the time to do before. In your episode for Listening to Fear, you spoke about the conversation Buffy and Joyce have about Dawn, and later read someone's email about it too. I had a lot of those same thoughts as you both and the email writer, but I also wanted to point out the connection between that conversation, Joyce's death, and Buffy's stance in The Gift. Buffy promised Joyce she would take care of Dawn, and she fulfills that promise here. Moving slowly through season 5 allowed me to fully absorb and understand just how exhausted Buffy was, and that she would be ready to give her gift by the end of it. Gosh dang, what a perfect season of television. So I thought this was so cool, because, you know, we do. We consume things so differently than we consumed them in the 90s and the early aughts when it comes to TV. And we get this totally incredible experience of not only watching things slowly, but watching them in so many ways. It's like we'll watch the whole season and then we watch the episode to watch it. And then we watch it to take notes. And sometimes we'll watch it another time to prepare for a segment. And, you know, we're seeing it. And then we get like conversations like these with Jen and Mac and LaToya, which bring even more to the table for conversation. So just really cool to know how we've factored into your experience, Meredith. And also really important point with Dawn and like and Buffy's promise to Joyce that she would protect her.
Well, here's yet another email with a really easy question, just a nice softball question for me. Jenny, can you please explore the music of The Gift, in particular Sacrifice, and tell us why it rips our hearts out? Well, I can try. As we discussed earlier in the season, Christoph Beck was not composing for the vast majority of season 5, right? But he is back for the finale. I wonder if that was arranged at a certain point when they still thought it was going to be the series finale. Mm. And they just like really wanted Christoph to come back and tie that bow.
Yeah. I also wonder, Jenny, I know this is your question, but I also...
Yeah, what the hell?
I just wonder if because of how much parallel and how many connections there are to not only prior episodes of this season, but also all the way back to Prophecy Girl, if it was one of those things where like they were collaborating then and they knew that this episode was, you know, like if Christoph had ideas before they knew when this episode was even going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's highly possible. It could have just already been composed as kind of the series closing theme. I think what makes Christoph Beck's score really work for me, like when it's really knocking shit out of the park, it's interesting because, like, you know, as modern like pop rock music listeners that, you know, many of us are, we're used to a verse and a pre-chorus and a chorus and a verse and a pre-chorus and a chorus and a bridge and a chorus out, and maybe a guitar solo. but score and composition doesn't adhere to the same structural business. What I think, you know, like they find a theme and then they expand on it, but like the score is often more, you know, through composed feeling, more like linear. You start here and you end there, and there's not like this sort of this structure of like, and here's the hook again, and here's the hook again. So what I think really, really like when Christoph's scoring is at its most devastating is when he has truly nailed a very simple, striking, resonant, melodic phrase right up front, and then he kind of just like expands on it, but it doesn't have to like be highly, like it doesn't have to keep referring to that theme in a very direct way. For example, in Close Your Eyes, the Buffy Angel theme, right? We have da da da
da da da. Come on now.
Yeah, okay. And then for Sacrifice, similarly devastating in a very similar devastation served up in a similarly like simple in air quotes feeling package, we have da 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 da. You know, whenever he's picking out a spare deeply upsetting melody in the right hand on the piano and then playing maybe some ascending chords in his left hand, you know, it's, you know that it's going to hurt you, and it does.
It does. It hurts me to hear you hum it. So you know you've
got... Yeah, I know. It hurts me. It hurts me to hum it, and I apologize for not being able to give you a more comprehensive explanation of why music hurts you. In my experience, you know, it just does.
Dear Jenny, why does music hurt me?
It's a mystery I've dedicated my life to exploring but not really solving, you know what I mean?
God. Oh, well, can we go far away from music hurting us for a moment and go instead to Mac McDade delighting us and I believe giving you full body chills one or two times
it's true.
In her conversation here. The thing about bringing new voices into the universe is that we're like five seasons in, so it just feels like we have so much to cover. When we bring somebody into the universe, we're like, okay, we can't do it all right now, but like, can you tell us some? And Mac had two really specific things that she wanted to talk about in season five. One was her feeling on Spike, which, you know, I mean, that's exciting. And the other is her feelings on Buffy as a character in this season. And I think it's really, this whole episode, like assembling it, producing it has been really cool because it is a testament to the fact that we all intake media, and this show in particular, so many times, right? Like, this show is a show that nearly anyone listening to this podcast has consumed more than one time, in more than one experience, and more than one period of time in our own personal lives and our own personal journeys. And so it's just really fun to like assemble something like this because it really showcases how many different experiences we can not only have individually, but how many different experiences like many different people can have about a given character or a given thing. So just really stoked about Mac being in the conversation. And yeah, Jenny, if you feel like ready for it, we can meander on over there.
Please.
Today's episode is brought to you by Regal Cinemas. If you're anything like me, you deeply enjoy going to the movies. Going to the movies is probably among my top three all-time activities. I love seeing films on the big screen. I also love being around other people who are watching the same movie with me at the same time. And of course, I love eating giant buckets of popcorn. If you feel the same and you like going to the theater, Regal Unlimited is something that just makes sense. Regal Unlimited is the all-you-can-watch movie subscription pass. It pays for itself in two movie visits. You can see any standard 2D movie anytime, no blackout dates, no restrictions. When you want to watch a movie in 4DX or IMAX or RPX or ScreenX, there's so many ways to watch movies these days, your Regal Unlimited membership gets you into those premium experiences at a reduced cost. And with Regal Unlimited, you don't only save money on the tickets, you will also save on your snacks. And as previously mentioned, I love snacks. The only thing that can make me love a snack more is saving money on buying a snack. Members get 10% off of all non-alcoholic concession items with membership. Regal Unlimited, all you can watch movie subscription pass. It pays for itself in two visits. So if you're planning to see two movies this month, join Regal Unlimited and sign up now. You can sign up in the Regal app or on regmovies.com/unlimited. Sign up for Regal Unlimited using code BUFFERING and earn 10% off your 3-month subscription. Please let us know about all of the movies you see and how the popcorn is.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Shared Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Wow! It was always just a matter of time until this moment.
Hi, Mac.
Hello, hello, hello.
I think that this is the first time that you are gracing our listenership's ears with your voice in the podcast proper space. Is that correct?
That is very correct. This is my first time here.
Welcome. Welcome to all of these ears. And, you know, I just feel like let's give the listeners an idea of what you're here to do today.
I have a lot of very big feelings about Spike. And particularly his arc in this season. And also I have some pretty big feelings about Buffy's general glory behavior.
Aha! Really on theme for where we are. Very important. It's like super important to get these feelings off your chest, you know, before we roll over into season 6. So where do you want to start? Do you want to start with Buffy and your Buffy feelings or Spike and your Spike feelings?
I think we can start with Buffy feelings because I think it includes more characters. Specifically with Willow, Buffy fears magic that she can't control and doesn't understand and cannot help her. Like, if it's not in service of her, she doesn't like it and can't handle it. So like, she knows Giles and his magic because it's from the Watchers Council and it's from books and incantations. She's fine with Anya's because it's demon-based magic and, you know, it's mostly used to help her, etc. But Willow's magic has never been about Buffy. You know, in fact, the whole Tara stint had nothing to do with her, and it was secret, and that's also the thing that makes her most powerful. By the time we get to the gift, Willow has taken on glory and lived to tell the tale, but like didn't take her on with a bunch of chants and whatever. She's throwing energy balls at a god. She's talking telepathically with Spike, and I'm sitting there going, I'm sorry, we're doing what now, Miss Willow? And then finally, I mean, she reaches into Glory's head and unmakes a part of her.
Wow, when you put it like that, I have to rub my arms furiously because I feel very weird.
Exactly. And Buffy is still perpetually like either blows her off or whatever because she can't control it. So I'm like, again, if you stop being dramatic and like upset that it's not about you, I'm pretty sure you and Willow could have figured out how to stop Glory if you stop just being so dramatic.
Well, and one of our like long-standing conversations, which we really haven't hit on as much in season 5, is about Buffy. I mean, really, Buffy and Willow's friendship, especially in the beginning, was completely one-sided. Like, even when you take magic and slaying out of it, Buffy really kind of takes from Willow what she needs and only recently has begun to make a bit of space for Willow in ways that seem better than they were in the last few seasons. But it's interesting to hear you talk about the magic element because, yeah, it's like if it's for saving the world, then thumbs up. If it's not, then...
Like, she resold Buffy's boyfriend. And that was before she became a hardcore magic, like, person. It's like...
Wow. Maybe Buffy is subconsciously holding a really intense grudge because Willow is responsible for the fact that Buffy had to kill Angel after he got his soul back.
Whoa.
What if she's chewing on that and she doesn't even know it?
Because Lord knows they all need therapy to work through that stuff.
I really...
I mean, you know...
Season 8, the Scoobies go to therapy. Please!
I want to ask you a question because this is the first time that you're here and you're talking to us What are your, like, you have very valid feelings on Buffy and her drama. What are your feelings on Buffy overall as a character?
So my whole thing, because I often frame Buffy in terms of the white cis heteropatriarchy, which is very much representative of the Watchers Council. And the thing with Buffy is, even when she tells them goodbye, she still works within the confines of their structure and their ideals. As much as she wants to be like, oh, I'm so different, it's like, no, you just have backup, so you're not dead. Like, you're still playing their game by their rules.
Right.
And
right.
That's what makes her so awful. It's like, girl, everybody else who stopped playing the game is so much better off. And I get, it's very much like feminists who are like, I can stay within whatever the shitty paradigm is to enact change. Like, at a certain point, baby girl, you gotta walk. But And I really think it also kind of circles back to the way in which Buffy values people. You know, Kendra and Faith were fine because they were backing Buffy up. Faith is fine because even when she goes off to do her own thing, when she comes back, she is a type of power that Buffy is familiar with and she knows will be in service of her or whatever the cause is.
Well, this is just all making me think about, like, Buffy is, as it is said within the text of the show, the chosen one, right? And like, I don't know if I've ever seen like a chosen one in a story that centers chosen ones be so into being the chosen one. You know what I mean? If you think about comparatively, Harry Potter, he is like the chosen one of his story, but he's not like the best wizard at Hogwarts, and he's not like exceptional in that way. And he also isn't like, I'm the chosen one, I have to do this and it has to be done my way, and I'm the only one who has the answers. Whereas Buffy really strongly takes that approach. Like, she's always the sort of like commander that everybody's looking to. Like, what are we going to do now, Buffy? And she takes it very seriously. Like, that is her mode as well. Just sort of saying, like, I am the one who has to have the answers. I am the one who has the answers. These are the answers. This is how we're going to do it. But that there is this like weird sort of like limitation on who can suggest what when, or, you know, whose power is valued at what time.
Something that's really interesting too, Mac, hearing you talk about this, is that, like, my brain, there's a part of my brain that resists it. And I bring that up because I think that people will listen and they'll feel that resistance. Well, like, but Buffy, right? And so I just want to, like, speak to it because, you know, I think that there's a lot of talk in the show about, you know, we're given the enjoining spell where they, like, bring their powers together. So it's spoken about, but the behavior and the way that Buffy operates and moves through the space does not align with what we're, like, getting from everybody else and from the script even, you know, from Giles's words and from the Scoobies' words. And I think that's, like, a really important thing to look at because it's easy, especially as, like, a cis white woman watching a show that centers a cis white woman, to be like, oh, the chosen one, and, like, she blah, 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 and to not see the pieces that you're pulling out and that you're pointing out, and to feel that resistance, you know, when you hear it. So,
oh, yeah, it took me several rewatches to be like, she's messy.
Okay, Mac.
Let's get horny. Is it time to get horny?
Yeah, I mean, let's take this ship upon the seas of Sunnydale and steer it towards the peroxide vamp in his trench coat with his black nails, because I know you have a lot of feelings. I'm certain that you have enough feelings for more than one conversation. But will you tell us some of your season 5 Spike arc thoughts?
Everybody likes to say that this is where he begins his journey of redemption. But they always equate it with Buffy, which I think is incorrect. There's specifically a scene that I think it's on the Instagram, the Buffy Instagram, where he goes, like, you know, you treat me like a man. And I don't think, like, that's not about Buffy. Like, because she's obviously treated him pretty terribly. And even when he was human, like, he knows when people are mistreating him. I think it very much had to do with the fact that she entrusted Dawn to him. Like, that's what he meant. Yeah, he helps them out, but he's chipped. Like, he doesn't really have a lot of choice there, right?
Like,
he's begrudgingly nice to everyone except Dawn. Like, he is always so careful and so gentle, and she is so fully accepting of him in a way nobody else is.
I mean, and a case could be made that Joyce is the other Summers.
She had tea with him. Like,
she loved Spike. She loved him so much.
We do also see him, like, another big signifier of Spike's decency occurs after Joyce has died, and he brings flowers with no card, intending to just kind of like leave them on the porch.
And that's exactly it. Is I think it's when people, it sounds absolutely ridiculous because he's a vampire, but when people take him at face value and go, okay, yeah, you kill people, but also you're still William the Bloody, is when he has the most growth, right? And I think that's true in real life, right? If you treat people, you know, gently and kindly, they'll often respond better and, you know, do better once they know better. And I also think that, too, we put a lot of pressure on Spike unnecessarily, because Spike has never been, like, outside of being, like, again, a little demon, has never been inherently evil the way in which Angel was. Angel wasn't a good dude before he was turned, as we've seen.
Right, right.
So that's why he was a horrifying bad vampire. But Spike, despite being, you know, a vampire, has always cared about Angel and then Drusilla. And, you know, even when, when he kidnaps Willow, like, he's always been this very caring person. So, like, when he was turned, you know, he was a weakling poet. It sounds terrible. But, like, that didn't change about him, because he wasn't terrible to begin with. Which is why I think he was capable of the arc that he was. Because, I mean, at the very end of The Gift, it's not that he's afraid that he fails Buffy. It's he's looking in the eyes of this little girl who, you know, he's taken care of and protected and knows there's no more he can do. And, like, that look, you're just like, that's the growth. It's not Buffy. It's not any of that. It's like that little girl who accepted him, no questions asked, that he, like, knows is going to die because there's nothing left for him to do.
I would like to respectfully request that you stop giving me full body goosebumps. Thank you.
You know, this conversation is just making me think, and some of this maybe is, like, obvious, but it's just, I don't know that we've ever said it so directly before, that, like, Angelus and Spike as two vampires, you know, not only do we see the humanity, obviously, in all the ways that you've laid out, but also, like, Spike has always loved as a vampire. And Angelus did not. I mean, you know, you can say that, like, he and Darla whatever, but it was not like rooted in this love place. It was rooted in a, like, killing together, lust only place, whereas Drew and Spike had much more than that and a much deeper level. And so I'm just, like, thinking about them both now in these, like, bigger brushstrokes of Spike's empathy and ability to sort of, like, pay his respects to Joyce. It's like when you think about Angelus, like, that wouldn't exist on his plane of anything. And so it's just interesting to think about it side by side.
Yeah, like, humanity was forced on to Angel. Like, Spike has always had his humanity. And even, like, you know, even when you think about him, like, killing the Slayers, you're like, you know what? He probably had some feelings about that, because so far we've seen him, like, when he's had to kill other people, have feelings, whether good or bad, in a way Angelus never did. Yeah, like I said, I have a lot of Spike feelings.
Yeah, well, you know, lucky for you, rumor has it that Spike might be around in the future of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, Mac, it's been so great to talk to you. Especially, yeah. Like, you know, we haven't gotten the chance yet to, like, have a bunch of Buffy Spike fun. And so this has just been a treat. And you need to come back and hang out with us in season 6 and tell us. Oh, can't wait to hear all of your feelings about season 6, Mac. I'm sure that as a listener, you know who Mac is at this point, because Mac, you've been working with us for several months now. But please go check out all that Mac does. You can join our anti-racism reading and discussion group. Mac is facilitating three books. We're focusing on one, but three books for October session. So you can learn about all of that and Mac at bufferingthevampireslayer.com/justkeepfighting. Also, Mac, do you want to tell them where to find you on social media, or do you want them just stay the fuck away?
You can find me on MacMac Talks Back, MacMac Talks Back on Instagram. And on Twitter, I am MacMac Talks Back, but there's no A in talks. So yeah, follow me on Twitter or Instagram. I post lots of things. Some of them are silly, some of them are Buffy, some of them are just wild. So
they're great. I followed you for a while, but I think I've been like, I must have been liking more of your content. So now it's coming to me more.
Nice.
And I'm like, Mac, you have a lot of commentary on pop culture all the time, and it's really fucking great to read. So follow Mac. Everyone's going to hear from you and Alba in just like a week or so. You're going to do a special episode with Alba about your time here. But we will see you back in this feed in season 6. Thanks
for having me.
Hell yeah. Mac. Come on now. Talking to Mac about Buffy is one of my favorite things in the world.
That's a light.
So thank you, Mac. As mentioned at the top of this episode, you can hear Mac and Alba talking more about their work with us next week, September the 16th. You should definitely tune in to that conversation.
Absolutely.
We have just a few more emails for you before we get into our conversation with LaToya Ferguson. That is where we're going to end this episode, symbolically looking to the future of season 6 and season 3, season 6 of Buffy and season 3 of Angel. I didn't mean to go off on this tangent right here, because now I'm in the middle of a sentence and that sentence is,
sure,
is siphoning off into this whole other sentence. But I believe in all of us to follow me. I just started watching Angel season 3 in like preparation.
Yes.
And I texted you something that the other day, didn't I? I texted you.
Yeah, you texted me a hot take.
I texted you a pretty fucking hot take, which was I'm 6 episodes.
Your hot take
was... I'm 6 episodes into season 6 of Buffy, and I'm 3 episodes into season 3 of Angel. And I was like, yo, Jenny, I think I like season 3 of Angel better than season 6 of Buffy. What?
Wild
hot take, so hot you can't even touch it. Also, listen,
no.
I know what comes in season 6 of Buffy, but like at this point, season 3 of Angel is wow,
coming in hot.
I'm like losing my shit. It's so good. So it may wind up, we were gonna have, you know, LaToya with a rotating cast of incredible co-hosts, but I might just elbow them all out of the way and take over season 3, because I have a lot to say. Anyway, before we get there, see, I'm now parting the sentences. No, I'm rejoining the sentences to leave off where I left off. I gotta go.
Good Lord. Didn't you have an email to read or something?
Okay, you're right. I do have an email to read, and it's in defense of me and Dawn. It's from Roderick. Roderick says, hey, I just wanted to jump very enthusiastically on the capital D defending Dawn train and mention that Dawn also put together, just from Buffy's expression, that she was going to sacrifice herself. Dawn is deeply intuitive, compassionate, and smart, and I defy anyone who says otherwise. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. In defense of Dawn.
Yeah.
I will tell you what. Hey. I'm going to be on this train. I'm stay on it. You can't get me off of it.
You stay on that train over there. I'm going to read this whole other email right over here. Faye, co-host of Her Dark Materials, which is a His Dark Materials book and show.
Yes, which I am on next week. I believe next Monday I will be on discussing, Jenny, not only discussing my feelings. This is good. You have to look at the Zoom screen. Jenny, not only discussing my feelings on His Dark Materials, but I also discuss a little mishap that happened to the Amber Spyglass.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it.
Yeah.
A mishap.
It's a great story that involves me, Jenny, and a kitchen knife in this trilogy of books. So anyway, yes, this email is from
not
Faye.
So subtle kitchen knife. Yes, Faye writes, I remember watching Buffy in the UK on BBC Two as it aired, although I think this was around a year after the US got it. Sky One got it earlier, but as a kid, we didn't have cable, only the standard five channels that the BBC was included in. I was around 10 or 11, and I remember them gearing up to the gift as if it was the series finale, so I watched it with that in mind, assumed that it was actually the finale, and then just went about my life as if that was how Buffy ended. I genuinely only realized that there was a sixth and seventh season when I bought the DVD box set years later. What a gift. I just thought she died at the end, and that was it for all those years. Jesus fucking Christ. Faye. Faye!
Faye! Imagine? Like, that's such a very specific experience. And now that we've read it, I'm hoping that we find some allies for Faye who may have had similar journeys with the series. And this is going to tie in. I mean, the reason that I put Faye's story in here and this next little note from Nairi is because LaToya has some feelings about series finales and season five versus season seven. So, you know, it's all going to tie in because, as Jenny said, I am a producer. Nairi wrote in, I kind of would have been okay with Buffy ending here. Then I redacted some of Nairi's reasons because they are spoilers. And Nairi ends, it feels complete here. Interesting take. Interesting take. We will be able to weigh in on that take in 2 years.
Yes. Can't wait.
Okay, the last listener experience of the gift that I want to share is from Bryn. Bryn says, I was fairly young when Buffy first aired, but my neighbors up the hill had the box sets, and I was allowed to borrow them after Buffy began. That meant I was behind on the episodes, and I ended up watching the season 5 finale in my family room the day before Thanksgiving. Needless to say, by the end of the episode, I was an absolute wreck. As I was sobbing, I heard the doorbell ring. My aunt, uncle, and cousins were at the door ready for the festivities, and my mom was calling for me to say hi to them. Well, 11-year-old me steps desolately out of the room to see my family bustling about. They stopped and asked what was wrong when they noticed my less than festive demeanor. I managed to blurt out, I just finished Buffy. My uncle immediately dropped the luggage he was holding and went to give me a bear hug. He then said in a soothing manner, there, there, don't cry. Death is her gift. That moment always meant so much to me. I never forgot how comforted and seen I felt. Thank you, everyone at Buffering, for giving me a space to tell this precious story. Sincerely, Bryn.
Bryn!
It's so sweet, her uncle. It's just so lovely. And also, like, I feel is symbolic of, like, all the things that we do here, right? Like, we feel seen. We feel seen here in our love, in our emotions, in our feelings about Buffy. We get to feel like, you know, we share it with the community. So, anyway, Jenny, I think it's time to go to our third and final conversation for this.
Oh, it's time.
Episode.
Do you like encyclopedic knowledge of an entire series and its spinoff? Do you like big series finale thoughts? Well, you're in luck because LaToya Ferguson has a fucking armload of all of that for you right now. And hey, we will be chatting with LaToya for the season premiere of Angel on Top, which is going to be moving into our main Buffering feed. So you will be getting weekly episodes from us in our sixth season. 1 week buff, 1 week out, 1 week buff, 1 week out.
Out is the spelling of out, in case you're confused, is A-O-T, which stands for
out. I'm trying.
As someone who has had a long history of Cordelia feelings, we're going to have a lot to unpack in this season of Angel, and I'm, like, really excited about it. I'm really excited, Jenny, because Cordelia has a really great new haircut and a lot of emotional growth. So I'm ready. I'm ready. But right now,
exciting stuff.
Let us go to talk to the one, the only, LaToya Ferguson. LaToya! Latoya Ferguson.
That's me.
That is you. You're here to talk to us about The Gift, but also just to like be here with us. We're so excited that in just a few weeks, you're coming into the universe to host Angel on Top. And if you listen to Latoya on anything Buffy tangentially related, so other episodes of Angel on Top, our episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you already know that Latoya, you are just a font of information about these universes, and it's a beautiful thing to behold.
I would say it was because I didn't have a lot of friends growing up, but like I had friends and I was still just a big old nerd who fell in love with Buffy and Angel. So
it's none of my business, but what? How do you know everything? Can you tell us your secrets?
TV, especially TV and movies, but especially TV, it just sticks in my brain. I could watch an episode of television for, say, the WB. I'll use Dawson's Creek as an example. So Dawson's Creek, I also came in too late. I didn't start watching until season 5, live on the WB. But TBS aired reruns in syndication, so that's how I caught up with that. When it aired in syndication, it played with the original music cues. So fast forward to streaming, DVDs and everything, music replacement. This is the thing a lot of people don't know. So Busy Phillips' arc in the final season of Dawson Creek, a lot of it involves her singing covers. A lot of that is cut out, and people don't know this because of music replacement. And I can remember the exact music cues from episodes. And I can remember, it's very jarring to me when it's replaced. Like, music replacement is something I care immensely about, and I just get so upset when it happens.
We texted you about The Gift, and you said that this episode specifically was one of the first that you ever saw. So I don't think in my brain I ever thought that you had seen anything out of order. So can you tell us about the experience that you had watching The Gift and where it falls in your Buffy experiences?
Yeah, so the first season I actually watched live of Buffy was season 6, and that's because...
Wild!
Right?
Just wild!
And that is because, so in the summer before that, I had seen a few episodes of Buffy just either my WB or Fox affiliate, just randomly. The 3 episodes were The Replacement, I Was Made to Love You, but not the body. And then, yes, exactly. And then I saw part of Tough Love, but the second half of Tough Love when they're at the cultural fair. So I see Tara's brain getting sucked out. I didn't understand her relationship with Tara. I was just a kid. Like the Willow and Tara relationship. I'm like, are they sisters? I don't know. And then The Gift. Those were the episodes I saw. So 3.5 episodes. I'm like, well, this show's great. And then FX started doing Buffy in syndication, from the beginning, in order.
I mean, I don't know that people understand anymore the commitment that you have to make, that you had to make to catch up on a show before a new season started, before the time of everything was on demand. True fans need only apply.
Yeah, FX was very, very helpful. Kind of like TBS was for me with Dawson's Creek, because I knew the schedule, knew when the episode was aired. If I missed it in the evening, I could watch it in the morning before school. Whereas when I was watching it in syndication on my Fox affiliate or WB affiliate, I never knew what time these episodes were on. I would just change the channel on a Saturday and hope it was on at 2 p.m. or something.
I mean, there's a couple of things that we want to dig into with you, but I think the first one is that this was, like you said, and also Latoya sent us both the WB's series finale advertisement, commercial, and the UPN's fuck off, Buffy's coming back, and now we're going to tell everybody advertisement back to back. But this episode was supposed to be the series finale initially. And you've talked to us a bit about your feelings on it as a series finale. So tell all of them. Tell all of the ears.
I think that The Gift is a perfect series finale, a perfect Buffy series finale. If I had to give up certain things in season 6 and season 7 for that, I would, honestly. Mm. That's my hot take.
Whoa. Hot take. Yeah. So your hot take. And obviously, we're not going to spoil, but your hot take is, if you had the choice between this being the series finale or the series finale of season 7 being the series finale, you choose 5.
Yes, and I would be giving up some big things. I am aware of this. One other aspect about me, you know, getting into Buffy is that this was before, this is a few years before I knew I wanted to be a writer in general, but like something about Buffy and its writing, its dialogue especially, like really drew me in. I would like go on BuffyWorld.com and like just look up quotes from Buffy, even episodes I hadn't seen, and just I'd have Vampire Diaries full of Buffy the Vampire Slayer quotes. Yeah.
the literal Vampire Diaries.
I think the gift, and part of the reason why it also makes a perfect series finale for this show, is that it's the culmination of a near perfect season of television, first of all, and like there's no fat that needs to be trimmed. Like every little thing you didn't even think was going to be important, like the Dion sphere or, you know, Olaf's hammer, just the Buffy bot. That's all. It all comes together. The Giles thing. And basically the story in general is just, it's like a perfect cap on that final discussion in Lie to Me, basically. While it's great to want to believe that Buffy, who has survived so much, like gets a happy ending, doesn't die young like the rest of the Slayers, I think it's kind of more realistic that she, you know, she dies saving her sister. She dies saving the world. She saved the world a lot. I think it's probably the truest episode there possibly can be of Buffy. And for it to also be the 100th episode, that I think it's just everything about it is kind of perfect in a way that it kind of should be the end.
Mm-hmm. I love that because I've been like reading a bit about our need for these like very happy endings. And, you know, I mean, the gift gives us, it's not like Buffy just jumps off the thing and there's no like monologue, you know, it does give us some of the like hope and belief that we need. But
I think another thing also, I'm just thinking of it now about it possibly ending here, is that it's kind of like one last F you to the Watchers Council, because what are they going to do? Buffy's dead. Faith's in prison and they're not bailing her out. They might send someone to try to kill her. It's not going to work. So you're screwed, you assholes.
Oh my God. I didn't even occur to me that Faith was now in charge again.
Yeah.
Like that there's, yeah.
She's the active slayer, you guys.
Yeah. I mean, everybody loves a good fuck you to the council.
I just like to imagine that there are people listening who are like mad at me for saying this should be the end of the show. And now they're like, maybe this should be the end of the show. <I know. laughs>
We're like, LaToya, we want people to keep watching it and listening to the podcast. No.
Well, what's really great is that no matter how right you might be or how satisfying of an end this might have been, we still have two more seasons to plow through.
Well, yeah, and to what you were saying, you know, I mean, you made it very clear that while you feel that the season finale of 5 would have been a better series finale, you said you're aware that it comes with some pretty big sacrifices, you know, like it's not like an easy thing to just let go of a lot of the things that we're about to tackle. So
yeah, it comes with sacrifices. And like I said before, it changes television fundamentally, too, if it just ended there. So I'm just saying it is a perfect episode of television and a perfect series finale, but that there is more Buffy after that is also good because Buffy's great, you guys.
Oh, my God.
I know, I mean, another hot take, but Buffy's great.
imagine that wasn't your opinion. And we're like, welcome to the universe. You mentioned, you know, Lie to Me as a piece of the arc, LaToya. And also, you referenced in your conversations with us this choice with Ben that Giles makes in the episode. And so I'm wondering, we talked about it a bit in our episode. It was sort of like one of the bigger themes of this idea between what makes a hero, and what decisions does Giles need to make? But I would love to hear you talk on that from your vantage point.
Well, first of all, like, imagine 12, 13-year-old me watching this, only having seen a few episodes, and then seeing, like, the dad character murder this cute boy.
Hell yeah.
That was an awakening of sorts. What kind of awakening? I'm still not sure, but... yeah, it's proof that, you know, these characters can make the hard decisions that need to be made, whether it's, you know, Giles killing Ben because that's what he has to do, or Anya holding that bat the way she does because that's what she has to do.
Really, for all of us.
You had sort of like casually posed the question of like, okay, yeah, Giles had to do this because no one else would have, but could anyone else have? And I was just thinking about it. And I think Anya is a good example of somebody who I think maybe could do it. I think she could have killed Ben. I think she's killed
LaToya
so many men.
Is making an incredibly skeptical face right now for those of you not buying it.
I think the last
Anya's
time...
Anya's very practical. She's very pragmatic.
I think the last time she could have done it was maybe in season 4, but post that, no. Too much humanity in her. Too much realizing what, like, the worldview of the Scoobies. Whereas, you know, Giles has lived, like, as a human. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously, Anya's lived, but, like, as a human, Giles has lived, you know. The emphasis makes sense, in my head, at least.
Yeah, no, I'm there with you.
Do you think Angel would have done it?
Yeah. I think Angel and Wesley would have done it. I don't think Gunn would have done it. I think I'm on the fence about Cordelia.
Oh, God. Cordelia, definitely, like, by season... By the end of this season, maybe.
Yeah.
Right? Wow. 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 Angel, I think, is a no-brainer. I mean, Angel, for all of his, like, brooding and you know, huffing and puffing and poetrying about, he did always have, like, the firm... I think he always had, like, the firm hand when it was needed of, like, nobody wants to do this, but I've been around for 241 years. I've been in Hell Dimensions. Fuck it. You know, I'll do it.
Yeah. He would, of course, beat himself up about it afterwards, but he would do it.
Actually, maybe that's
just grist
even
for the mill. For
yeah,
Angel.
I was gonna say maybe more. Right,
he might be running out of stuff.
He just has like a chest in the corner where he keeps like backup fucking brood material.
Uh-huh. More books to read in the dark.
Wait, do we think Angel has a vampire diary? Surely.
I mean, he has a vampire sketchbook. We know this.
Oh yeah, literally. I was coming here to say the exact same thing for sure. Many vampire sketchbooks.
I mean, there are like the vampire chronicles and stuff. So that like he doesn't need to write his own vampire diaries because everyone else has.
But like, doesn't he, LaToya? Do you think Angel cares if it's been written before? Don't you think he's the kind of guy who just really feels like it's happening to him for the first time in a different way?
Well, no, at least Angelus is such a narcissist. He loves reading about himself, so he's not going to write about himself.
That's true. I think that Angel has a vampire diaries that are his feelings, not history, not like a historical account of his existence, but more like, you know, I was eating rats,
dude.
Then, like, I, you know,
huddled in the back seat of a car in Los Angeles, parked in a driveway of a high school, staring at a girl with a lollipop, scrawling, "I have to know her. I have to. The risks are great, but I must."
Jenny, yeah, I see
like,
you. I see you, Jenny.
A year later, just like passion.
I mean, exactly. Surely the whole voiceover for the episode Passion is written down in a vampire diary somewhere.
Yeah. And I'm sure I've already made this fucking joke, but Angel's diary, he also burns the edges ever so slightly. Double dramatic effect for him because of the threat of fire, but also the dramatic effect we all got in the 90s when we did it to our poetry.
Agreed.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my God. Fucking LaToya. I'm speaking on behalf of Jenny and I and saying we are so fucking excited to jump into season 3 of Angel with you for, I mean, many reasons, but God damn it, if this isn't one of them, I can't wait to just talk to you about Angel's diaries and... On that note, LaToya, always a joy and a pleasure. Thank you for bringing us your thoughts on the gift and storytelling and all those things.
I do have a question, though, because I haven't gotten to do it yet. Can I howl with you two? I haven't gotten a chance to do it.
Oh my God, that's right. Because the episode you were on didn't have a howl. I would love nothing more.
I would be fucking honored. I hardly feel qualified to howl along with you, but you will be adding an incredible amount of howl cred to us. Till next time.
Yes.
Hell yeah!
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.